This is OzCat Radio, 89.5 FM, KZCT, Vallejo. I'm Jeremy, and this show is all over the road. Welcome. A real treat today. You know how you meet people who just keep popping up and they always have these unbelievable stories to tell, and one day you realize, wow, what a remarkable life this person's living. I'm going to introduce you to such a person today. I met John Steele back in the 70s, working radio in Boulder, Colorado. We saved the world, then we went our own ways. Every 3 years we'd reconnect, and the stories just kept getting wilder. At first, he's a cameraman for Independent Television News of London. He lives with a suitcase packed in his closet. Suddenly, he's their go-to hotspot cameraman. He's in the stands. He's in Moscow for the fall of the Soviet Union. He's flying through anti-aircraft fire out of Georgia. He's hiding under houses in Rwanda. He's running Sniper Alley in Bosnia. Every time I hear from him, I worry a bit more because it seems he lives for it. But it's not the bullets that get him. It's the PTSD. He wakes up screaming on the floor of London's Heathrow Airport. He doesn't know how he got there, he doesn't know who he is, but they find a business card in his pocket, and ITN comes to collect him. Fast forward through a hard recovery, and he's back at it, ultimately in the Middle East, in Iraq, just in time for W's war, and he has finally seen too much. He puts down his camera, he walks away. He purged many of his demons in his memoir of that madness, War Junkie, One Man's Obsession with the Worst Places on Earth. He filmed an award-winning documentary on the Iraq surge. He currently lives in Switzerland, and the final book of his fantastic Angelus trilogy has just been published. We'll talk about all of that anyway, but first, a track, because music is what we do. So, how do you lead into a conversation like this? Well, there are so many choices, but I met Steele in Boulder for a Stones concert. So this bit of world-weary reportage from them seems perfect. I'll be right back with John Steele. Stick around. No, really, stick around. This is going to be good.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith. Around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain, made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his fate. Pleased to meet you, hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game. Stuck around St. Petersburg when I saw it was a time for change. Killed the Tsar and his ministers. Anastasia screamed in vain. I rode a tank, held a generous rank when the blitzkrieg raged and the bodies stank. Oh, yeah. Get down in it.
I'm Steven trying to figure out when the last time we saw each other was. Late 90s, probably, in Boulder.
Mid-90s? Outside the Hotel Boulder.
Yes, exactly.
And we went to dinner.
Right, exactly. But when was that? As I recall, the last I heard, you were looking at going to Hong Kong for the handover. You had not gone there yet. You were just telling me that that was about to happen, that it looked like that was where you were going.
Okay, then that would have been about 1994. That would have been 1994.
Yeah. Right. That was kind of my take on it as well. So just trying to get the timelines right.
Yeah, from 94 to 98, that was 4 years where my biggest travel year that year was 309 days. And the next one was 308 days. The next one was 307 days. And then the last year, because of the handover, I spent a lot more time in Hong Kong.
Right.
Uh-huh. But those were the years when I did most of my travel in my job. Because in Russia, I did a lot of travel, but it was inside the ex-Soviet Union, except going to Africa.
Right.
Hong Kong was when I really started traveling all over, you know, every country in Asia. But it was actually, that was the time that I was actually writing War Junkie during that time. Uh-huh. When I was in Hong Kong and traveling all the time, because War Junkie was basically written in airports.
It's All Over the Road. I'm Jeremy. And before you say, hey, you started without us, you're exactly right. I did. A week or so ago, actually. John and I have talked a couple of times getting this together. I always knew this was going to be long form. So stick around, and if you can't catch it all, I'll put it up on the website as a podcast so that you can catch the rest of it if you had to leave in the middle. When I caught up with Steele last week, he was in Lausanne, Switzerland. That's where he lives right now. It's on Lake Geneva. It's surrounded by hills and Alps. It's a wine-growing region. And I'm chatting with Steele, and I'm hearing this booming in the background. And okay, he was a war correspondent, so I might expect that when he was, you know, out on the job. But not in Lausanne, you know, really. I asked him about it. What's going on in Lausanne right now?
It's evening now, and we're just finishing a thunderstorm over Lake Geneva coming out of the Alps. It can be extremely dramatic and a little bit dangerous for the wine because, last year we had a hailstorm that came through 4 or 5 minutes and it wiped out 80% of the crop last year.
Wow.
This year, it's been a perfect growing season. So every time we get a thunderstorm, everybody gets a little bit nervous. And what the Swiss actually have here is that they have a small army of guys who are connected with the Swiss meteorological people. And if there's a danger of a storm passing over the vineyards, they notify the wine growers who get out with these little cannons and start blasting
Wait
into
a minute.
The sky to break up the hail.
Real cannons?
Yeah, cannons, yeah. They're you know, not great pieces of artillery. They're sort of small things. And they fire these small shells into the clouds, and the Swiss meteorological people tell them exactly what altitude to set the detonators to go, and they hit the altitude where there'll be the greatest chance of hail or the greatest collection of hailstones, and the explosions break up the hail and make them small pieces, so you know they won't harm the grapes when they fall. It's wild. I mean, it does. The first time I heard it years ago, I sort of hit the ground, you know, thinking, you know, incoming, boom. it's all settled down now, so it's all rather peaceful.
We don't get the thunderstorms up in Napa. I'm trying to imagine that and thinking, no, you know what? Let's keep quiet about that. We don't want them getting this idea. They'll just be out there firing off cannons.
Yeah. Yeah, they'll just be doing it for fun. You know,
right, exactly.
Glasses of wine and say, let's fire the cannons for laughs and see what happens. You know,
so, you're not going to wait for a thunderstorm, that's for sure. So, you ended up in Lausanne. We'll get back to that, I'm sure, because a lot of the Angelus trilogy takes place there. A lot of it starts out there, was conceived there. And so we're going to go through a lot before we get to that, because that's years, that's decades in the future from where we are right now. And where we are right now is starting out back in radio in the 70s. However, I do want to let people know where we're going. What do we expect out of the Angelus trilogy? What can you tell us about it? What's it about?
Everything that ever was, I think.
So, FM in the 70s. It's all over the road on OzCat Radio, talking with author and former radio DJ John Steele. When I first met John Steele, I was in Albuquerque, and I had won tickets to a Rolling Stones concert in Boulder, and when I got into town, I heard someone that I had worked with in Albuquerque on the air, so I dropped by to see her. And long story short, by the end of a 15-minute talk, I was on the air at overnight and had a job if I wanted it. And so I went in early and sat in, and the person I sat in with was Steele, and we ended up being pretty fast friends by the end of it. And so I had been listening to him on the radio, and I figured, well, this guy's a pro. We can talk radio pro to radio pro, you know. So I walk in and I say, so how long have you been doing this, John?
Yeah, this is my first job.
I couldn't believe it. So how did that happen? I mean, okay, and this is, you just basically walked in and got a radio job. You had no experience?
No, I didn't. I was actually in New York working as a mailman, and having a pretty tough life, and as one does in New York at that time, there were a lot of a lot of drugs about and that sort of thing, and it was kind of a confusing time. But one thing that sort of kept me going was I was a big fan of WNEW-FM, when especially Jonathan Schwartz, who was on from 6 to 10 in the evenings. Then there was Allison Steele, no relation, who is known as the Nightbird. Scott Muni, Dennis Elsis.
Oh, yeah, it was a great cast.
Richard Neer. I mean, these were guys who I spent a long time with just listening to, and they turned me on to the creativity of FM radio at the time. And I was a pretty unhappy mailman, as well as being, you know, probably the world's worst mailman. And maybe I'll try radio. So I got my FCC license and went out west and came into Boulder, Colorado, and they put this new station on the air, and they needed people who would work cheap. And that was me at the time. Yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah, me too.
And it was just, it's one of those things, it was a great team of people. Dennis Constantine was the program director, who is, considered a legend in the business. And, he sort of put this thing together, and the more confidence it built with the people working in the station, the people that own the station, and the people doing the job on the air, the more freedom we started to have. And that for me was just great. You know, I was having a great time, and I really enjoyed it, because it was, there was nothing better. The best part of my life before that in New York was, you know, just sitting in the dark somewhere, listening to the radio and listening to the music and the way they put sets together and the way they make setways and the stories Jonathan Schwartz would tell on the air and that sort of thing. I just thought that, you know, that's magic.
Well, and you were natural at it. I mean, that was obvious from the fact that it was your first job and you sounded like you'd been doing it for years. I would never have guessed that when I went in. The station, by the way, you're listening to OzCat Radio, KCCT in Vallejo, and I'm going to drop that in right there because now I'm going to throw in some other call letters. KBCO is the name of the station, and I need to put that in because I think it's going to come up in this little clip right here. This station ultimately ended up being kind of a legendary station, too. And when you talk about the staff, it kept being that way. Since sometime in the mid-70s, I had had this idea for April Fool's Day, because April Fool's Day is the radio holiday. You can do anything on April Fool's Day, and people do. And I wanted to send the station 50 years into the future. And suddenly, I was working with a station, with a staff that I could envision going on the air and pretending that they were 50 years in the future with a totally different history and all of that stuff. And so as a bridge through here, and because it's a flashback to Steele's past, I'm going to drop in a segment here from our April Fool's project in 1979. And so we'll be back with John Steele after this word from our sponsors.
You know, it's sad, but there just isn't any wood furniture left on Earth anymore. It was all burned for fuel back in the energy-starved 20th century. Oh, sure, you can import a tree from the forest colony circling Ceres, but who has that many credits in their computer? I hate to say we told you so, but we did. You see, at Contemporary Cushion, you could have invested a few ancient dollars back in the 1980s in a beautiful butcher block sofa, a sofa you'd be proud to own. And you know what? You'd be a millionaire now. Oh, what a difference 50 years makes. Do you know what a piece of wood is worth on today's market? But there's still good news. You can still buy a beautiful butcher block sofa at Contemporary Cushion in our antique and relic section. It'll cost you a lot more now, but who knows what it will be worth in the 22nd century. We told you so once. We hope we never have to tell you so again. Contemporary Cushion, in Boulder, Lake Santa Fe, New Mexico, and at our factory outlet on Cirrus Colony 111B.
It's back, and just in time for the holidays. It's Francis Cook Pilatidis' multi-sensory epic Intervention Day, winner of 37 Nebula Awards and the J.L. Morris Award for Historical Realism. This colossal multi has delighted audiences across the galaxy. It's the true story of the first Intervention Day back in 1999, when Earth was saved from nuclear annihilation by alien intervention.
People of Earth, we have been more than patient.
Critic Mark Rogers says the scene where the missiles are snatched from the air and the Galactian spaceships appear may be the most exhilarating moment ever captured. This Intervention Day, treat your whole family to the multi-sensory experience that's been a box office smash for two decades. Felix Ruddlehaus and Anne Turin star in Intervention Day, a multi that made history about a day that changed the world.
A Mark John Dinglemeyer production.
Oh, what a great day for a parade.
Well, it is now.
It is wonderful.
20 minutes ago, you never could have convinced me you could go out and have a parade in the midst of this.
Absolutely. Welcome
weather
to...
Weather control, how great it is.
It is. Welcome to live coverage of the Intervention Day Parade here on KBCO. It's been a whole year since
the
last
year?
One here
Are
in
the
year.
You ready for it, Clone of John
I'm
Dennis?
I'm so ready, Jeremy, too. This is going to be really exciting. I hear there's some great floats
I've
just
heard
about.
The same.
The crowd is excited. Everybody's having a great time. Lots of banners in the air against a nice blue sky.
Snow looks out of place when it's so warm all of a sudden.
You can never tell. You can never tell.
Really?
I think they're about ready to begin with the parade.
We should mention that this is a telepathic parade, of course.
Down the street, I see something over at the other end of the mall, Jeremy.
Ah, yes, that is. It's the lead float. It's coming in quite strongly now.
It is. I can feel this one very clearly. The colors are starting to take shape right now.
Okay. The Boulder Intervention Day Parade, led by one of the leading multi-galaxy corporations, the Celestial Seasonings Float.
Jeremy,
what a beautiful
Are you receiving what I'm receiving?
Boulder Valley.
The Boulder
centuries
Valley.
Centuries ago.
Long before man had arrived.
Rolling plains.
This is absolutely
Isn't
amazing.
It something? I can. Look at all those trees. Can you imagine that?
Trees. It's been
They've
so long
really
since I've seen a real
float,
tree.
They? Yeah.
They've done a lot. There's
Boulder
the Boulder Creek coming
what
down
is
the middle.
That down off the
that,
creek?
Do you know what that is? That's an old tale. They're having tea down there.
What does that guy have that funny? Oh, that's the Mad Hatter.
Mad Hatter, Alice in Wonderland. These are legendary old tales.
Ancient
drinking
teas from around the universe in an unspoiled galaxy. What a float.
Very good float. Our compliments to you.
Celestial Seasonings Float.
Great float.
He was once considered just another rock and roll musician. We now know he is the Master Prophet. The Celestial University Programming Federation is proud to present this year's Intervention Day Memorial Concert. Ladies and gentlemen, an evening with Neil Young's brain.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceships flying in the yellow haze of the sun.
You're listening to All Over the Road on OSCAT Radio, 89.5 FM in Vallejo. I'm Jeremy, and I'm speaking with author and, at this point, former radio DJ John Steele. So radio being what it is, suddenly you're gone, and the next I hear, you're coming down from Wyoming, where you've been working on your television chops. And so you told me you had gone to, where, Washington, D.C., and suddenly you have a job as a TV cameraman?
Well, yeah, the story was after I left BCO, I sort of hung around Boulder for a while and thought, well, I'm not really going to get anywhere here. I did a little freelance work in other stations, but I wasn't really going to go anywhere. And, you know, the medium was changing, and I was not going to fit in it anymore. But I got a job with National Public Radio, and it was going to be a great job. I was going to, on the arts side of National Public Radio, I was supposed to work with a group of people who were going to go around with this gigantic, beautiful Neve soundboard, and we were going to record symphony orchestras. And I thought, oh, that's a great job. Mm-hmm. And I got to Washington, D.C., and it just happened to be at the exact moment NPR went bankrupt, and they pretty much closed off everything. And, you know, before I even started my job and got to fill out the form and get my welcome to NPR packet, you know, there was mm-hmm. no job. So I didn't quite know what to do. And I being in Washington, D.C., there were a lot of TV crews who needed sound people around. And I imagine I started talking to people and seeing who might need a sound man, and started doing a little freelance work with CBS and a couple of other outfits. And I got hooked up with Independent Television News of London, which is the commercial news service as opposed to the BBC service. And at that time, News at 10 was the dominant news program in the UK. And very important, a very important news voice around the world. Channel 4, which is today just as, you know, is some people say is even, you know, more important, was just getting started at that time. So I had the chance to get in on the ground level with these operations. And it was the same thing with radio. I just sort of fell into it and learned tricks from other cameramen and things. And there came a time where they needed somebody to shoot something, and there was no one else around. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And I did it. And luckily, I didn't screw up. And it happened to be what we call a stand-up, what Americans call a stand-up, what the British call a piece to camera, where the reporter is standing in front of the microphone and saying, so, and this time, blah, 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 that sort of thing. And And I knew enough about lighting that I had to get a nice backlight on him, blue light, you know, and on his hair and shoulders and everything, and compress the traffic coming down the street and hit him with a nice soft light and did deep focus on it and everything else, you know. Because the thing is, it doesn't matter what you do. As long as you make a reporter look good in his stand-up, he thinks you're the best cameraman ever. Uh-huh. You know, this guy told London that I was a very good cameraman and they should hire him. So they hired me on the basis of a stand-up. But I was very gung-ho, and I was very keen to learn as much as I could because I wanted to travel. Mm-hmm. And at this time, this company was the only bureau they had in the Americas, South America, Latin America, and North America, was the Washington Bureau. And these are the days when television companies had lots of money. Mm-hmm. And we traveled everywhere. You
know, in this
South
hemisphere.
America, Central America, North America. And I was also, I had a credential to the White House. I was part of the White House press corps. So I traveled with presidents through all over the country in political campaigns and around the world on state visits. So when you get a job like that, you know, you just want to keep getting as good as you can at it to keep traveling because it was great fun.
Mm-hmm. You probably have another book in all of that period of time because that whole period of time doesn't really enter into War Junkie at all. It's years later that you get back there.
I wasn't big on keeping notes as I am now. I didn't start keeping diaries. And I mean, I always kept diaries as a kid and things, but mm-hmm. and would always hide them. And I would always write some poetry, and I keep journals and things. But I didn't start doing it really seriously until I started working in when they sent me to Russia. When I started doing some world trips, and they posted me to Russia for for 4 years. That's when I really started keeping journals. So if I was writing about the time before that, before War Junkie, it would all be lies.
So those diaries are ultimately going to take us into War Junkie, which covered just a remarkable period of history. And it's the point where you were their go-to conflict cameraman at that point, working out of Moscow. So give us a snapshot tour.
War Junkie starts with me having a bit of a nervous breakdown in Heathrow Airport, basically around the time of my birthday in September. And it goes back 1 year, almost a year to the day, to 1993, September, and traces from that point to how I ended up on the floor of Heathrow Airport a year later. So it's 1 year at a look at the life of a cameraman who works in dodgy places like I did at the time. And we start off in Sukhumi, Georgia, where Edward Shevardnadze was trying to hold off a battle, or an invading army actually, coming down from Abkhazia to break up the country. And what's fascinating about all this is the same guy who was doing the operations in 1993 is the same guy that's the president of Russia right now, Vladimir Putin, because he was KGB at the time, and all these things were KGB operations. And it moves from there, which is a pretty dramatic place of trying to get out of Sukhumi on basically the last flight. There were two flights. The one before us got shot down right in front of us. From Sukhumi, you know, we do get out, and we get out back to Moscow on the same day that Yeltsin dissolves the parliament and Moscow falls into chaos. So there wasn't even a chance to take a breath.
In the USSR, been a USSR. Well, the delivery girls really knocked me out. They leave the West behind. And Moscow girls make me sing and shout. That Georgia's always on.
Listening to All Over the Road. I'm Jeremy, and I'm talking with author John Steele, currently about his first book, War Junkie, One Man's Obsession with the Worst Places on Earth.
Back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are, boys. Back in the USSR. Well, the great girls really knocked me out. That Georgia's always over my, Oh, show me round the snow, big mountains way down south. Take me to your daddy's farm. Let me hear your bell like it's ringing out. Come and keep your comrade warm. I'm back in the USSR. Hey, you don't know how lucky you are, boys. Back in the USSR.
There became this two and a half week running street battles through Moscow. They kept getting increasingly more violent to the point where a group of rebels who were disenchanted with Yeltsin and all the broken promises of a better life under democracy took the Belladoma, the Russian parliament, which they call the White House. Mm-hmm. This very tall white building in Moscow, and that set off a 3-day battle that cost hundreds of woundings, and you know people were killed. You know the tanks had to come in; they started blowing up the building, and I ended up inside the building at different points. It was a pretty messy affair. After Moscow, I took a trip on the Trans-Siberian Railroad from Vladivostok to Moscow. In those days, having a Russian press pass, I could fly as a Russian, and it cost me $18 to fly from Moscow to Vladivostok, which is another way of like flying from here to San Francisco, from Switzerland to San Francisco. Then there was another battle in Georgia, and then the horrible tragedy in Kigali in Rwanda kicked off with the slaughter of the Tutsi people by the Hutu majority and that were running the country at the time. In many ways, that bit of that year, being in Rwanda and Kigali in the time of the genocide, and how dangerous it was, and you know how many hundreds and hundreds of people I saw slaughtered in the aftermath of the slaughter, and people suffering and people wounded, and the battle that was going on. It was so terrifying on so many levels that the effect of it actually never left me. And without a break, I moved across the border to Zaire. Because what happened was the Tutsi rebel army kicked out the Hutus, and they all ran across the border to Zaire to escape, a lot of them being the killers who carried out the genocide in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And on the other side of the border, they just dropped at a town called Goma. And it's this high African plain, and there's no water. And you had 100,000 people. All these people living very, very rough with no facilities, no food, and as I said, most importantly, no water. And it was just a matter of time before cholera broke out. And like Kigali, this was a place where the memories of Goma will never leave me. Mm. it's almost impossible to imagine that sometimes I remind myself, sorry, it's just hard to talk about.
I can tell.
It's very, it's difficult to express the effect of GOMA on me. It's because I sometimes have to remind myself that, you know, I watched 35,000 people choke to death in a week.
Mm.
And I was basically staying with the French army, but spending all my days, in these places where people were just dropping dead. And cholera is if you think about one of these horrible, medieval diseases that you just think you would find in a horror movie that would like terrify you. I mean, cholera is it. Mm. It hits you. And if you don't get intravenous fluids within, an hour and a half, 2 hours, you're dead.
Wow.
And it is a pretty horrible, horrible death. So you'd just be walking on these crowded roads and people would just drop right in front of you. Mm. And as I said, it's a very horrible death. So it's hard for me to remember, but sometimes I have to remind myself of the reason these things affect me. So is realizing that you see, tens of thousand people, dying all around you. And I stayed in the middle of that for 10 days, I think. 10 days, I think.
Hard to even imagine.
10 days. And then I left. And then War Junkie sort of ends with me in Sarajevo on a particular day very close to Sniper Alley, where a young girl was gunned down. And that was kind of the breaking point, because what had happened was we had driven to the Army Command, the Bosnian Army Command, because we wanted permission to go to one of the front lines, and you always had to have permissions or, you could end up dead. Reporters and journalists and cameramen, we all drove around in armored vehicles that could withstand a bullet at range. And if there was something blew up nearby, you had a much better chance of surviving. It wasn't guaranteed survival, but you had a better chance than just driving around in a, clapped out Toyota. And whenever we'd stop in anywhere in Sarajevo, you have to remember Sarajevo was a city under siege, surrounded by Serb forces, and snipers would shoot across the Drina River, or artillery would come down from the mountains. And still, as with all these places I've been, there are these flashes of what looks like normalcy, or life just trying to be normal. And you come up on some of these back streets that were out of the way of Sniper Alley, or there was no shelling going on, or things seemed reasonably calm, and parents would let their children out onto the streets to play. And they would hide in sheltered areas. This day we went to go see the army to get permission to go to our front line. We pulled up in front of HQ and there were some kids playing in the street. And as always happens, we come out of the truck and in our bulletproof vests and everything, and they say, bonbon, bonbon, candy, candy, candy. And we would always carry candy around and give it to the kids. And we had to get into this meeting, and I looked at this one girl and the kids, especially one girl who grabbed my hand, asking for candies. And I didn't speak Bosnian, and they didn't speak really a lot of English except, what they learned on TV when they had TVs. And I explained, as we do, with your hand signs, I don't have any candy on me. It's in the truck. I'll come right back and give you some. And, okay. That's an English word everybody knows.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the meeting, and we started to hear some Bosnian snipers fire out across the Drina River into the Serb sector. And at that particular moment, a guy I was with, Sandy McIntyre, said, if they don't stop that, somebody serious is going to fire back. And we could still hear the kids' voices playing out in the street. And a few seconds later, there was this almighty crack of what we knew to be a Russian sniper rifle firing a 50 caliber round. And it just cracked down the street, ricocheted, and everything went quiet. And it was one of those oh my god moments. And I ran outside, you know, I got my camera and started taking pictures. And the girl that I had told to wait for Candy's had taken a bullet in the neck. That was sort of the beginning of the end for me. And it was coming off the back of that trip when I was supposed to go to the States that I was passing through Heathrow Airport. And that's when, as I say in the book, the world fell out from under my feet.
I'm your masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain. Like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon. I watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
Music from Bob Dylan on OzCat Radio, Masters of War, a song that's too nice by at least half. I'm Jeremy, and you're listening to All Over the Road. Today we're speaking with author John Steele, and we finally reached the point where War Junkie, One Man's Obsession with the Worst Places on Earth, is being written in airports.